And tonight, our main speaker is Elsa Kay from Beverly Hills.
Hi, my name is Elsa. I'm an alcoholic. I have to see how I see better. I'm not sure yet. Really nice to be here. I want to thank Gil for inviting me tonight. And boy, there's some nice perks in AA. You get dinner. You meet nice people at dinner and you get put up for the night. And then back to Los Angeles I go tomorrow. So nothing wrong with that. When I'm a little nervous, I have a eye twitch, which is about to start. I can feel it. I have a misfire of a seventh cranial nerve. If anyone has a little vial of Botox or something and thinks they can hit my seventh cranial nerve, be my guest, because I am sick of this thing. But so if it happens and you notice it, nothing's wrong. It's just the usual misfire. But and the only reason that I mention it is once at a meeting, it was my eye was really going to town. And after the meeting was over, someone in the meeting came, only in AA, came up to me and he thought I had been winking at him. And I looked at him. I don't know what I would do with a 30-year-old. And someone who is still into goth. And I thought, oh my God, you know, only in AA. So that's the reason, in case my eye starts going to town. I drove up from Los Angeles today. And I came up by myself. No one likes to ride with me. One reason is the only thing I will listen to music-wise in the car is classic country. I love classic country. And Waylon and Willie and all that stuff. And people are not into the twang anymore, but I really like it. And so I've had one or two experiences where people have asked me to turn that down, and I just won't do it. And another reason people don't like to ride with me is we have to consider the temperature of the car. I will never get over that northern Minnesota upbringing. And you need parkas, sweaters, mufflers, beanies, gloves in the car with me. You cannot get a room cold enough for me. And I don't know why I'm living in Southern California. It is just too darn hot. I miss Northern Minnesota. I miss snow. And I should maybe do something about it before it's too late. But anyway, my sobriety date is August 21st, 1992, so I'm 32 years sober. I gave it a try in 1991, which did not work, but to be 32 years sober after a 25-year drinking career is just pretty incredible to me. I used to like to get all poshed up and go to fancy bars and drink in Beverly Hills, which I did when I was drinking. And you know, 25 years later, I ended up sitting on a curb at 83rd and Avalon in South Central Los Angeles, swinging around containers of Night Train and yelling at cars. And that's where alcoholism took me. And I never was afraid in that atmosphere. I do not recall anything happening to me, and I never ever remember being scared. And I think a lot of times when women get themselves in that kind of a position, you start looking for places where you can go and be a kind of no one's going to see you and no one is going to know you. And no one knew me in South Central Los Angeles. So I spent quite a bit of time down there during the last year or so of my drinking. And it wasn't really that bad of a place to bottom out, I guess. But I'm glad I did. And like I said, 32 years of sobriety after, you know, pretty hard end and pretty hard drinking for 25 years is something that I absolutely want to hang on to. I am, like I said just a second ago, I'm from northern Minnesota. I miss it, and I remember when I lived back there. I left Minnesota in 1966, but nowadays you hear people starting to drink when they're very, very young, and I didn't do that, but I do remember the first drink I had. I think I was about 14 years old, and I was at my uncle's farm, and everybody in those days, I'm really dating myself, they called them highballs, and it was some kind of a holiday, and they gave all the young people there a little drink. And everybody pretty much made a face, spit it out, wouldn't drink. I wish I had written down the date of that drink, because it absolutely changed my life. The very first drink I ever had at that ridiculously young age made everything look different. I was always an overweight kid, teased and bullied in school, and none of that mattered after that first drink. But of course, when you're 14 and you're still living at home with your parents, you can't be chasing around alcohol like that, and especially in a small town. But you know, over the next, I don't know, maybe couple of years, maybe when I got to be 16, something like that, we were able to sometimes sneak into 3-2 beer bars. We lived in a very, very small town. There were 3-2 Country Western beer bars there, Grain Belt beer. And there was an Indian reservation, Chippewa Indian reservation, about 9 miles out of town. And sometimes we could sneak into there and drink too, but it was never really a problem. But with a little bit of sobriety under my belt, I remember that I was the one, even in those very, very early days of drinking, who always took it up a notch. It was just different for me. And I think somewhere in my DNA, I was probably born an alcoholic. I didn't cross an invisible line. I didn't drink myself, you know, into alcoholism. I was an alcoholic drinker from the very first drink that I ever had. And now it just kind of makes sense, but it certainly really had a lot to do with everything that happened to me for over 25 years. And even after that, even after sobriety, alcohol can have a real bearing on your life. But I also remember in those earlier years, the feelings of discontent, irritability. I wanted to get away from my mother. I was sick of that little hick town. And in 1966, I talked to a girlfriend of mine from Minnesota, and we moved to Long Beach, California. And there's a lot of people here who are probably a little bit too young to remember the middle 60s and the early 70s, but oh my God, trust me, it was nirvana. If you had any bend, any kind of addiction at all, you were in. You know, the social consciousness of the country was changing. Their Haight-Ashbury was happening. There was just a lot going on. And I just kind of blended into the beach scene in Long Beach. The people were smoking a lot of weed. I was drinking. And I never have had much of a drug history. It's probably my generation. But during the early years of my drinking, weed was really a big deal. It was $8 an ounce then. I think it might be a little more expensive now. But I took piano lessons when I was growing up for years and years, and I guess I had some really good dexterity to my fingers, because I was rolling weed like you would not believe. That those joints were coming out of my apartment like they were flipping off of a conveyor belt. And I always said that Zigzag should have put me in a training film. I was that good. I could get about 47, 48 perfect joints out of an ounce of grass. The neighbors loved me. You know, I was kept very, very busy doing that. And I smoked a little weed in those days too. But I remember the day I quit, I caught a look at myself in a full-length mirror, and I just was shocked. I almost fell back. I said, "How many Sara Lee cheesecakes do you really need to eat every day? And what is so funny anyway?" And that was absolutely the end of my weed smoking. I just went back to booze, which was my first love, and I stuck with it until the end. And the only other thing I ever did drug-wise, and this was maybe 54 or 55 years ago, I took mescaline one time. And I know this isn't setting a real high bar, but I still think that might have been the best day of my life. I remember that like it happened last week. And oh my God, the colors. And it was just absolutely fantastic. But nothing could really get me away from alcohol. And I just stuck with booze for like something like 25 years. And, you know, for the first 10 years or so of my drinking, I always call those years the glory years of my drinking. And I don't know if I should really call it that or not. Because, you know, some bad things happened, but they were still the glory years of my drinking because I was still able to work. There weren't a lot of problems. I remember there being some problems, but not problems enough where I would even consider not drinking. But little by little by little, you know, it catches up with you. You have absolutely no idea what's happening to you. And almost at no time during the whole 25 years that I drank, I don't think I ever sat down and said, "Oh my God, you're an alcoholic." And people were pointing out my drinking for many, many years, but I just don't see how I didn't see it, you know. And toward it didn't even take that long that I would be coming home. I'd be crying sometimes when I came home, and I was drinking every single day. And I had this whole setup at home because I was getting hurt when I was drinking. So I would pull all the throw rugs up off the floor in my apartment. And there were times that I had really gotten hurt falling into a bathtub, a porcelain bathtub with faucets. Probably look in the mirror, go, "Ah," and just fly back because you're so horrified. And I, rather than taking a look at the fact that I was falling into my bathtub because I was always drunk, I just went out and bought about 18 or 20 pillows and padded the whole thing to like soften the blow. Then there were the next time I went falling into it. And none of that seemed so unusual to me. And I had a piano then, and I would tape really thick pieces of foam around the corners of the piano and my coffee table, and in case I ran into one of those, and then maybe I wouldn't get so hurt. And my big finish for the night was to tape the knobs on the burners of the stove in case I decided I was going to turn out yet another gourmet meal, which is just an absolute joke, start the place on fire. And then I had an ingenious invention about how I could put a straw in a glass of water, and I won't go into it, and keep it there without it bobbing out. And I would put a towel around that glass of water because I knew that I was going to pass out soon. And once I came to, I would not be able to pick up that glass. I would be too shaky. But I was always able to pull that glass toward me and suck up some more of the vodka until I calmed down. And when that is your routine almost every night, and you really can't see that something is wrong, you're beyond human help in all likelihood. But that was just almost the norm for me, and I honestly didn't see where my life was headed. It just seemed like normal to me. You know, I've heard people say that the alcoholic life is the normal one. And that's exactly what I relate to in Alcoholics Anonymous, that the alcoholic life did become the normal one. And also another thing I relate to so much in the book is the feeling of impending doom. Even someone in my condition had a sense of impending doom. It didn't do one thing, not one thing. I just drank and drank and drank no matter what. So, you know, I carried on the best I could, but I don't know, maybe 10 or 12 years in, I'm thinking I somehow have to start maybe trying to pull myself up by my bootstraps, as my mother would always say. And eventually I began looking for ways to maybe curb my drinking. Absolutely nothing worked. I was into, I don't know what the attraction for me is into, like, the gray zone and the underworld and people who are in it, but I just think that's the coolest thing ever, and in a way I kind of still do. And I remember when I was still drinking in bars, I met a guy, and this was in the saloon in Beverly Hills. I loved to drink there, and he offered me a job. I can't even remember when this was, sometimes in the early 80s, something like that. And he was starting a business during the early 80s. He was a publisher, and he and his partners were publishing a guide for people coming in from England for the 1984 Olympics, which were in Los Angeles. And he asked me if I wanted a job. Well, I thought it sounded fabulous to work for in the publishing with all these salespeople coming along, and I just ran in and quit the job I had and went to work for him. And, you know, I asked absolutely no questions whatsoever. It sounded so appealing. And he said, you don't have to drive to the office when you start work. The office will pick you up. And in a day or two, when I was going to start work, he said, we're going to send a ride for you. And they sent a limousine to pick me up. Well, that did it. You couldn't have gotten me out of there with a gun to my back. I remember walking out the front door, seeing that limousine out front. I was hoping my neighbors would see me. And I climbed into that thing, and I stayed there for about 4 years. And all I had to do on that job, they didn't even have an office. They had a big house by the Bel Air Hotel, and I was just so impressed with these people. It was just ridiculous. And all I had to do was sign checks. That was my job. Now, that was going to come back to haunt me after a few years. But they were smart enough to know that I would be so scared if something happened that I would crack at the first question. So I really didn't know really what they were doing, except I did know that they were money launderers. And that's who I was working for. And money launderers, and it makes sense, you can't drag bags of cash into a bank. without raising eyebrows. So the smart money launderer knows how to set up a legitimate business, and they can launder money through that legitimate business. And so that's who I worked for 4 years. And they actually published that guide for tourists, and right about the same time that there was a little knock on the door, and it was one of those up against the wall visits. And all of them went to jail, one for over 20 years, and it was over. The business was over. And I was embezzling money there too when I was working from there. And when I was 7 years sober, I was on a plane. I was on a plane to a prison in Ireland to make an amends. And I thought during that flight, there is something wrong here. You were embezzling from money launderers, but you're the one flying to Ireland to make an amends. And to this day, that kind of baffles me, but I owed that amends and I made that amends. The person I owed the amends to was in prison in Ireland, wasn't a political prison, but it took about a year for me to get clearance to go over there. So, you know, once you get sober and decide to follow through with what you're supposed to do, I did it, and I'm glad that I did it, even though the irony was absolutely not lost on me. But I went out and I got a regular job after that, which was just a disaster as I remember it, and starting to look for ways to maybe be able to stay sober. And one of the ways, sometime in the late 80s, something like that, I had met someone and gone out with him for about a year. And he finally said, "Do you think that we should get married?" Well, what was wrong with him? I was never sober once when I was with him. I was always drunk, but he had custody of two daughters, those poor girls. And I think they were 13 and 14 or 12 and 13. And so we got married. We got married in Las Vegas. And I always say that someone needs to file a class action suit against wedding chapels in Las Vegas. When the bride, the blushing bride, is so drunk that she has to be held up on both sides to get married. Do you really marry that couple? Well, they did. All I remember was a desk. That's all I remember. But the next day, I kind of knew that I had probably taken it up a notch. And I moved in with my husband, and I don't know, I kept it together for maybe a week, something like that. And it occurred to me after maybe a week that I couldn't stand any of them. I couldn't stand him. I really couldn't stand those girls. I couldn't stand their friends. I couldn't stand the music. I couldn't stand driving them to school. I just couldn't stand it. And he loved to entertain, and he'd invite people over for dinner. And I was expected to get in that kitchen and rattle those pots and pans. And I cannot tell you how many times we were sitting at a dining room table, and I would come out of a blackout and just wonder, who are they? Or who cooked? You know? And it was just like that. I once came out of a blackout in the vice principal's office of the girls' school and had no idea where I was or what I was doing there or what they had done. Not that I really cared, but I just wanted to drink, and I wanted to drink without anybody being on my back. And, you know, I managed to last there for 180 days. It sounds like a sentence, but That's how long I was married. And away I went. And I probably have to really look back and know that I wasn't serious about this because I never gave up my own apartment. So I had a place that I could go back to. And, you know, of all the amends that I have had to make, it has just been murder finding this family. And I finally did some years ago. You would think two girls would be on Facebook or Instagram or something like that. And they just weren't. But I did find them, and I wrote a letter to both of those girls. I never heard back one word. I hope they got the letter. It never came back in the mail. And the letter I wrote to my ex-husband came back in the mail to me, and he had written on it return to sender and hadn't even opened it. So I don't know, and maybe someday I'll have another chance. I really hope that I will have a chance, because that really affected those girls so adversely, and I have always felt really, really bad about that. But I just kept, you know, carrying on, and it was just awful in those years. There were times that I could work, there were times that I couldn't work, and eventually I was seeking out places to go where nobody would know me. And, you know, finally I ended up in South Central Los Angeles, where nobody knew me and nothing really happened to me. And it was a fairly safe place to bottom out and drink. And I tried to get sober in 1991. I was put into a rehab unit by my sister and a friend of mine. And I lasted there for maybe 3.5-4 weeks. I remember coming to in bed. I showed up and checked in drunk. And when I came to, I took a look at the nightstand in the room, and there was a big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I think a 12 and 12. And I thought, Jesus, how did it come to this? You know? And I stayed there for maybe 3.5 weeks, something like that, maybe 4 weeks. Got out of there. I don't know how. I stayed sober maybe a week, something like that. And I just knew I hadn't had my last drink. And I started a plan of one day I would go to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous and not drink. And then the next day I wouldn't go to a meeting, and of course I started drinking. And at some point within maybe 3 or 4 weeks, I was carried back to that place and spent one night there, kind of a spin dry, and then just signed myself out against medical advice. And I'll tell you, that last year or so of drinking was just horrible. Ambulance rides. I would try to take myself off of booze myself, which is a terrible idea. You know, when you're drinking, I don't know, maybe a couple of fifths of vodka a day, and you just all of a sudden stop, you might have a couple of good days, but on that third day, it is absolutely no joke. And there's a restaurant in Manhattan Beach called The Kettle. And I remember having seizures and convulsions right in the gutter in front of that restaurant, and hauled out of there in an ambulance. And but stuff like that, I just didn't care, I guess. I don't even know how to really describe it. I think you're just not ready until God says you're ready. But one day, and this was, I don't know if it was August 21st, 1992 or not, that's my sobriety date. My sponsor gave me that sobriety date because I couldn't think of a day that I was clean. And she said, if you really don't know when you had your last drink, we're going to go long. And that's the day that I used. And I remember coming up the back stairs, going inside. I was crying. I knew what the night was going to be. I would start drinking, I would pass out, it would be that whole circle and cycle all over again. And you know, that day I was about to make myself a drink in the living room, and all of a sudden I felt a presence in the room with me. Not a voice, not a touch, nothing like that at all. I just felt something in the room with me. And I knew in that second that there was a God who had been looking out after me for the last 25 years and just waiting for a moment to tap me on the shoulder, because apparently that God felt maybe I stood a chance of getting sober at that time. And everything changed. That I never made that drink, and I absolutely never had another one. And all I did was go back to Alcoholics Anonymous, just as simple as can be. AA is so simple and so easy in so many ways. I don't know why we try to complicate it and screw it up all the time, but all I did was go back to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I did everything everybody else in this room has done to get sober and to stay sober. And you know, it takes you a little bit of time to get your sea legs and figure out what you're going to have to do to stay sober and be comfortable staying sober. And it did for me too, but it just got easier and easier and easier. And now I've been sober for 32 years. There have been some blips in the road, that is for sure. When I was about 12 or 13 years sober, I almost went out. That close scared me half to death. I was tired, complaining about being tired. Someone said, here, drink these, they're Red Bulls, you'll love them. Well, I loved them a little too much. And pretty soon I was drinking those things like they were vodka. Just pouring them down right and left. My car was full of them. They didn't have to be cold. Face was red all the time, grinding your teeth. They're just terrible things. And One day I had gone to Costco and got three or four cases of those things and put them in my kitchen. And I was at home and I looked at those and I said, I don't think I would want anyone to see four cases of Red Bulls in my kitchen. I think I'm going to hide them. And you know, when I got sober, I had 40 quarts of vodka hidden in my apartment. It was in boots, laundry baskets, towels, between sheets. I just love to be surprised. And, you know, so I am hiding 40 quarts of vodka, and now I'm going to hide four cases of Red Bull. And the light went on, and I thought, I'm going out. I think I'm going to go out. And, oh, gee. I was so scared and so sweaty and shaking. I dumped every ounce of liquid out of those cans. I didn't even trust myself to throw them in the dumpster. I can retrieve a bottle of thrown away booze like you wouldn't believe. I can do it with my toes. I have done it probably dozens and dozens of times. There are some things I'm good at. I am good at disposing empty liquor bottles, which are heavy and noisy, and I never put them in my own trash. I would wait till 2:30 or 3 in the morning in my neighborhood and go pitch them in other people's dumpsters. It would be like, 3 for you tonight, Rabbi Coonan, and away I'd go, you know, somewhere else. And, you know, after I had this Red Bull scare, I went down to H&I and got prison clearance, and I knew I needed a real serious commitment. and I got a jail panel, unit 161, Twin Towers, men's side, which, oh, talk about a challenge. And I kept that panel for something like 3.5 years. Now, everything had calmed down before then. But, you know, I've had some good experiences sober, some bad. I remember being so reluctant to do amends, just scared stiff to do amends. But, you know, I did them. There are some that didn't turn out well. I'd say I had maybe a 50-50 record with amends. But you do what you can. You know, you keep your side of the street clean, and you just do what you can, and stay out of the results, which was very, very difficult in many cases, especially when you owe money. And I had remembered taking money again from someone else. I was really an awful little embezzler, and I had taken about $10,000 from another old friend of mine. And when I went to him to make an amends for that, I was prepared to pay it back. This is probably the worst thing that happened to me making amends. He looked at me and he said, "Elsa, it was never about the money." He said, "It's just that I had trusted you." And that's like getting a kick in the gut. And that's something I have never forgotten, and I hope that I never do. I hope that I never go back there to have to experience any of this again. I stick really as close as I possibly can. And you know, I'm running out of time. This went really fast. But there are times, you know, you can just live a wonderful life in sobriety. And some of my girlfriends and I, once in a while, we treat ourselves to a nice brunch in Santa Monica, some of these beautiful hotels. And we were there not too long ago. Beautiful food, beautiful people, beautiful surroundings, beautiful everything. And, you know, I was kind of looking around and I thought, I don't think anyone in this room would look over at me and say, "See that natural blonde over there? She spent 25 years rocking back and forth with a bottle of vodka in her lap." I don't think anyone would take me for that at this point in my sobriety. So of all the things Alcoholics Anonymous has given me, I feel that it's given me the ability to at least look like I fit, even though much of the time I still feel that I don't. But that's good enough for me. And so I owe profound thanks to this program for having a second chance at life. And it's been so wonderful that I just plan to hang in there and keep it up. So, boy, that went fast. So, thank you, everybody, for your indulgence tonight. And I'm just going to sit down. Thanks.
Give her another round of applause.